Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 24, Chanting the Song Sung by Lord Shiva and Lord Shiva. Text 36. Namo Namo Nirudhaya.
Namo Namo Nirudhaya.
Rishikendriyatmane.
Rishikendriyatmane.
Nama Paramahamsaya. Purnayanivrittatmane. Nama. All obeisances to. All my obeisances. Namaha. Obeisances again. Anirudhaya. Lord Aniruddha. Rishikesha. The master of the senses. Indriya Atmane. The director of the senses. Namaha. All obeisances unto you. Paramahamsaya. Unto the Supreme Perfect. Purnaya. Unto the Supreme Complete. Nipritta Atmane. Who is situated apart from this material creation. Translation responsively. My Lord, as the Supreme. That didn't go well actually because I broke up the grammar a bit strange. My Lord, as the Supreme Directing Deity. Known as Aniruddha. You are the master of the senses and the mind. I therefore offer my obeisances. Unto you again and again. You are known as Ananta, as well as Sankarshan, because of your ability to destroy the whole creation by the blazing fire from your mouth. My Lord, as the Supreme Directing Deity known as Aniruddha, you are the master of the senses and the mind. I therefore offer my obeisances unto you again and again. You are known as Ananta as well as Sankarshan because of your ability to destroy the whole creation by the blazing fire from your mouth. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Rishikeshendriyatmane. The mind is the director of the senses and Lord Aniruddha is the director of the mind. In order to execute devotional service, one has to fix his mind on Lord Sri Krishna's lotus feet. Therefore, Lord Shiva prays to the controller of the mind, Lord Aniruddha, to be pleased to help him engage his mind on the lotus feet of the Lord. It is stated in Bhagavad Gita 9:34, Manmanabhava madbhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru. The mind has to be engaged in meditation on the lotus feet of the Lord in order to execute devotional service. It is also stated in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Matasmriti Jnanam Apohanam Cha. From the Lord come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Thus, if Lord Aniruddha is pleased, he can help the mind engage in the service of the Lord. It is also indicated in this verse that Lord Aniruddha is the sun god by virtue of his expansions. Since the predominating deity of the sun is an expansion of Lord Aniruddha, Lord Shiva also prays to the sun god in this verse. Lord Krishna, by his quadruple expansion, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, is the Lord of psychic action, namely thinking, feeling, willing, and acting. Lord Shiva prays to Lord Aniruddha as the sun god, who is the controlling deity of the external material elements, which constitute the construction of the material body. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the word Paramahamsa is also another name for the sun god. The sun god is addressed herein as Nibhritatmane, which indicates that he always maintains the various planets by manipulating the rainfall. The sun god evaporates water from the seas and oceans and then forms the water into clouds and distributes it over the land. When there is sufficient rainfall, grains are produced and these grains maintain living entities in each and every planet. The sun god is also addressed herein as Purna or complete, because the rays emanating from the sun have no end. For millions and millions of years, since the creation of this universe, the sun god has been applying heat and light without diminution. The word Paramahamsa is applied to persons who are completely cleansed. When there is sufficient sunshine, the mind remains clear and transparent. In other words, the sun god helps the mind of the living entity to become situated on the platform of Paramahamsa. Thus, Lord Shiva prays to Aniruddha to be kind upon him so that his mind will always be in the perfect state of cleanliness and will be engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. Just as fire sterilizes all unclean things, the sun god also keeps everything sterilized, especially dirty things within the mind, thus enabling one to attain elevation to the platform of spiritual understanding. I'll read the verse one more time. My Lord is the supreme directing deity known as Aniruddha. You are the master of the senses and the mind. I therefore offer my obeisances unto you again and again. You are known as Ananta as well as Sankarshan because of your ability to destroy the whole creation by the blazing fire from your mouths. Om agina tamarandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshua anmalitam jena tasmai sri gurave namaha. Shri Guru Paramananda Premananda Phalaprada Vrajananda Pradananda Sevayam Mahayoja. So when I was reading this verse this morning, and especially the word-for-word translation, and then the Prabhupada's full English translation, I realized that this is another one of Srila Prabhupada's purports that would very much aggravate mundane scholars, especially scholars of Sanskrit, because Srila Prabhupada appears to be doing something unorthodox to a person with less intelligence. In the verse, we hear praises, namo namaha, and addressing Lord Aniruddha, and then he's addressed with the words Rishi Kendriya Atmane, Paramahamsaya, Purnaya, and Nibritatmane. So these different words, word-for-word translation is the master of the senses, the director of the senses, the supreme complete, and one who is situated apart from the material creation. So these appear to be different ways of addressing Lord Vishnu or Lord Aniruddha. But in the translation itself, English translation, Srila Prabhupada translates all those names as you are known as Ananta as well as Sankarshan because of your ability to destroy the whole creation by the blazing fire from your mouth. So where does that come from? So it seems that this is quite a surprising translation. And somehow or other in the purport we also get to the point of the sun god, that this is addressing the sun god. So yesterday we read in the verse that spiritual knowledge is very sukshma or subtle. So the previous acharyas are able to draw out and identify very subtle concepts and ideas within the verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam that ordinary people will miss. So Jiva Goswami in particular and here Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur are identifying these names of Lord Aniruddha as referring to his expansion as the sun god. And we heard some ideas in the purport of how that was so. So if you have less developed spiritual intelligence and less scholarship, you'll miss these things. But it can be quite easily understood that when you address a person by a particular name, then you're referring to a particular quality that they have. Just like devotees, they address Krishna as Hari. So in Sanskrit, Hari means one name is a monkey or a thief, which is more or less synonymous. If you've visited Vrindavan, you'll understand the relation. And that may not appear to be very flattering to Krishna that he's a monkey or a thief. But not even for people who know the pastimes of Krishna as the butter thief, even people who are referring to Lord Vishnu. They understand that Lord Vishnu steals away the mind and the senses of the devotee. And by stealing away his mind and senses, then he also steals away the lusty desires of the devotee. And if his lusty desires are stolen away, then his sinful reactions are stolen. And by stealing the sinful reactions, then all suffering is also stolen away from the aspiring devotee. So in this way, a simple word like Hari, it implies many things. So here, some of these words to address Lord Aniruddha, they refer to the sun very nicely. Just like the word Paramahamsa, Aniruddha is addressed Paramahamsa. So literally this means the supreme swan. So the swan is distinguished. I've never seen it, but they say that if you put a mixture of milk and water, that the swan can drink, and water will be left behind in the bowl, and the milk will have disappeared. So that's quite unique for a swan. And in the same way, the sun has the ability to take out what it wants and leave other things behind. And because of that, it has purifying potency. For example, when there is something unclean on the ground, for example, urine, we don't really need to do anything to clean it. You don't need to scrub with soap and water. If the sun just comes out, it will evaporate the water, and the water that was once urine, it becomes completely clean and purified, fit to drink. Later it will come down as rain. And by the sun's heat, the earth is purified of any contamination. So in that way, the sun can be addressed as Paramahamsa. And this purifying quality is brought out in the purport, Krishna's ability to purify. In fact, all purifying agents that we can see here on the in the earth can all be traced back to the purifying potency of the sun, because the sun is the controller of all material elements. And even material science will support this fact. Just like we look at the material elements themselves, there's earth, water, fire, air, and ether are the gross ones, and then mind, intelligence, and false ego. So all of these things can be used as purifying agents. Earth in particular, we're instructed in the Pancharatra that metals can be purified, burying them in the earth for 7 days, and then when they're dug out, they can be used for deity worship, even if before they'd been contaminated by something else. Because minerals have the ability to absorb impurity, and this is used by industrial manufacturers, this knowledge. They put different minerals in the refining process. For example, carbon is well known to absorb impurities. When devotees are sick, sometimes they take these charcoal tablets. And in a subtle way, also minerals can absorb impurities. For example, in the fire jagya, sometimes a plate of salt is shown before the people present, and that is said to absorb any negative impressions or envy or lust that is present in the minds of the people witnessing the jagya, or a marriage, for example. And these minerals that can purify, they're actually produced by the sun. So how is that? Because the chemical reactions that cause combinations of elements to create minerals, that's driven by heat, actually, which is provided by the sun. And minerals themselves are deposited on the earth because of the actions of weather, freeze, thaw, and other phenomena of the weather, which is also driven by the sun. Later on, the earth and the minerals may be transformed into other kinds of rocks and jewels, etc., by the influence of heat. Metamorphic heat will transform them into something like, for example, a diamond. Water, another one of the elements, is a purifying agent, and for that reason it's said that the Brahmana can be without anything in this world apart from water. It's the one thing he can't do without, because in the morning water will purify the gross body and the subtle body as well. And you can feel it actually after a cool shower. The people that you meet on your way to the showers are not the same people that you meet on the way back. You know, when you see them on the way, it's like, like this. This is the conversations that we have before we get in the shower, whereas afterwards we feel enlivened and can begin to make spiritual exchanges with each other. And this water cycle, Srila Prabhupada refers to it Nivritatmane, that the water cycle is driven by the sun also, and he describes how that happens through evaporation and so forth. Fire is another element that purifies. directly and indirectly. Directly, scientists, they use fire and heat to purify metals of germs. For example, the scalpel, when they're going to cut inside a body, they'll first put it in either infrared heat or they'll put it in a steam. The old-fashioned way was to put it in steam. And you can burn piles of rubbish and thereby purify the earth. Also, we have the fire is actually produced by the sun. Even when we use matches, for example, to create heat and light, that's nothing but the stored energy of the sun. Because through photosynthesis, plants capture the energy of the sun, and then through combustion, that same fire and energy is released. So in that way, the sun is providing heat and light, which purify the earth. The air, also wind, is a purifying agent. If you have silk clothes or woolen clothes, you don't have to wash them every time you've worn them. You can hang them in the fresh wind, and this wind will purify them. So how is the wind produced by the sun? It's because when evaporation occurs, or when heats the air and it rises, this creates a movement of wind into the vacuum created by that rising air. So the different wind patterns on the earth and all of their complicated concentric circles that drive tornadoes and cyclones, that's all produced by the energy of the sun. Also ether. Ether is a more subtle material element, but it's like a big storehouse for mental impressions and different types of energy. So as we know that if this energy is positive, it will create an uplifting atmosphere. And when it's negative, especially when there's an absence of the sun and it's dark and cold, then naturally the mind and senses will become depressed. And Jayabhadra and Rupa Manjari, they were describing that when they went to Sweden, the devotees were really anxious to have them come there at a particular time of year. And they said, "We know it's austere, but please come in the winter, because in the winter, even the devotees, we feel our mind and senses becoming depressed." And actually, statistics show that in these places in the Arctic Circle, in the winter, suicide rates are very high. One might wonder if devotees living in such conditions are at a disadvantage. But we're very fortunate that devotee association creates the energy of that transcendental sun. It's just like in matches or in a light bulb, some energy of the sun can be stored and then released. So devotee association actually captures some of that energy of Krishna, transcendental energy, and then it will enliven devotees who are being affected by bad conditions in the ether. And similarly, Srimad Bhagavatam, by reading Srimad Bhagavatam, it said that this Bhagavatam is the light that will dissipate the darkness of ignorance. And by worshipping Gorni Thai also, I was thinking they're also like sun and moons that have arisen on the horizon of Goldadesh. So devotees, they can come in contact with Krishna's transcendental energy. But as we can see, in any case, all material elements are dependent on the sun. And even Srila Prabhupada hints in the purport that without the sun, there will be no life at all in the universe possible. Because without the sun, we don't have grains, and then we don't have food. So it's said that there are some living entities on this earth that exist in complete blackness. If you go down far enough in the ocean, no light penetrates. And there's places I heard in the Marianas Trench where there are small fish living and their bodies are adapted to high pressure and no light. In fact, the fish have no eyes on their face. Or some of them have a small, like a tentacle, and on that tentacle is some photochemical that produces its own light. But even those creatures, they depend on the sun, because for their food, they take the decomposed bodies of other fish that live near the surface that depend on plankton. And those bodies, they filter down, and these bottom feeders at the bottom of the ocean, they eat those bodies. So everyone, directly or indirectly, is dependent on the sun. That's another reason why we don't eat fish, because they're considered the stool eaters of the ocean. Just like on Earth we have the hogs, so in the sea there's the fish. It said here that the sun goes on producing this energy in unlimited quantities since time immemorial, and therefore the sun can be referred to as Ananta. When we say Ananta, it means unlimited, and that's one way of referring to the sun, because his energy seems to be unlimited. Also in Brahma-samhita, the sun is referred to as Vishesha. What is it? Asesha Tejas, that he has unlimited effulgence or unlimited potency. So the sun itself will go on producing heat and light until finally Lord Ananta, at the end of the material manifestation, he destroys it with the fire of devastation. And at that time, all material elements will also be absorbed into the body of Mahavishnu. So apart from that destruction that's generated by the Lord, the sun will never be vanquished. Shishi Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. The sun has arisen. Probably what's more interesting for devotees even than the different material potencies of the sun and the transformations that it generates is the way in which the sun has control over the subtle mind and senses. And these things are always giving trouble for the trouble to the devotees. The Lord is addressed as Rishi Kendriyatmane. He's the master of the mind and senses. So just as we refer to the mind and senses as being a charioteer holding various reins, and there's five reins that the charioteer is holding. So the mind is controlling five senses. So in the Bhagavad Gita it's said that if any one of those senses is left to wander at will, it can create havoc in the life of a devotee. And we see that certain senses are likened to certain animals, that when they can be controlled by one of the senses. Like the deer, for example, when he hears the flute playing of a hunter, he's attracted and he'll wander into a trap, or he'll wander into the range of the archer who'll shoot an arrow and kill him. And the fish, he's controlled by the sense of smell. For example, the shark, it's well known that he can detect a particle of blood in the water from 3 or 4 kilometres away, just a drop of blood. And his nose will bring him there. And it'll bring so many other sharks also that if one shark, in his anxiety to get the whatever animal has been wounded, if he bites his own tail, then he'll become so frenzied he'll try to eat himself. So these animals are very much controlled by their senses. I can't remember the one actually. I know the moth, he's attracted by the brightness of light, and we can see the wasp. He's attracted by sugar, which we suffer from every day. You see them, they're like suicidal kamikazes into the hot tea at breakfast. So even these senses actually are a cause of danger for a devotee. And the mind is like a genie. It's very chanchalam, or always restless. You can't trust it. It's said that if we engage in devotional service very attentively, especially chanting and hearing, then we bring the mind and senses in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's the complete pure. Oma pavitro pavitro vasava vashtam gatopi va yashmaret pundarik kaksham sabahyabhyantraha suchi. That if one simply remembers the Supreme Lord who is beautified by lotus petal eyes, no matter what condition one's in, one becomes purified both inwardly and outwardly. But the problem is that the mind and senses don't want to remember the Supreme Lord who is beautified by lotus petal eyes. Rather, they're attracted to mundane sense objects for the purpose of enjoyment. And that way, although remembrance of Krishna has the potency to burn the seeds of sinful desire, we're not really throwing them right in the fire. It's like at a fire jagya, some of the barley corns or sesame, they're thrown into the fire and some stay on the outside. They're just heated up a little bit, but they're not destroyed. And yet, if we're unable to control and discipline the mind and senses, Srila Prabhupada said this is animal life, it's not actually spiritual life, and the devotee won't be able to remember Krishna at the time of death when the mind and senses are very agitated. Srila Prabhupada describes such a person to be like a parrot, because a parrot can be trained to chant superficially. And in Christchurch in New Zealand years ago, we had a cockatoo, one of these white parrots with the yellow crest. And we had him for many years, and he would chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. When he would get excited, he would get a little mixed up. He would also chant, Hare Bol, Jai Prabhu, and he was an interesting bird. He was a big attraction at the temple. Sometimes you'd put your finger in to scratch him, and he'd be very, you know, affectionate, and then he'd turn around and he'd bite your finger very hard, and then, he was a funny bird. But unfortunately, I was instrumental in his death. He used to get very bored. I mean, parrots are very social creatures, and sometimes he would just scream out of boredom. So I got him a big aviary that was made of wood. But this wood, I found out later, it was treated with some chemical. And the bird, he occupied himself. He was very happy in that aviary. He used to bite and gnaw the wood. And I think maybe that's what made him sick. He got very sick, like poisoning. And he started to hang upside down from the perch and then fall to the bottom of the perch. And I got really worried one day. I was driving him to the vet to try and get some treatment. And I was with my husband and Rishabh. And on the way, we were chanting Hare Krishna to him because we thought he's going to leave his body. But instead of chanting Hare Krishna in response, which is what he always used to do, he just began to scream and flap his wings. And he was just like this. And then he left his body on my lap, actually, on the way to the vet. So I could see that while he made eternal benefit from being in the association of devotees, he himself wasn't able to fix his mind on Krishna, because when he was chanting, he was obviously thinking of something else. He had no realization. So in the same way, the devotee is in a precarious position if he just externally engages in devotional service but is unable to fix his mind on Krishna as he does it. It's not a secure position. But it's said here in this verse in purport that Krishna is Lord Aniruddha. He can help the devotee control his mind. So how is that possible? I was thinking recently about the Gayatri Mantras and reading a book compiled by Sachinandan Maharaj about different information about Gayatri Mantra. So the first line of Gayatri Mantra, it's well known actually to many people in India, and it's described also in Srila Prabhupada's books, so I guess it's okay to say something about it. But the first line of Gayatri Mantra, Krishna is referred to indirectly as Savitur, or the sun, Surya Narayan. And he's described as enlivening or enthusing the three worlds, Bhur, Bhuva, Sva, the lower planets, the middle planets, and the upper planetary systems. So when we meditate on Krishna, then we become enthused. Actually, the power even to meditate on Krishna, that comes from Krishna himself. And one of the later lines in the Gayatri Mantra refers to Krishna as Govinda. So Govinda means the enlivener of the cows, the Brahmins, and the senses. So Krishna, he gives enthusiasm to fix the mind and senses. He gives pleasure to those mind and senses. And the way he does it is explained even more deeply in the last line of the Gayatri Mantra, which refers to Krishna as being a transcendental Cupid. So Cupid is a partial manifestation of Lord Pradyumna, another one of the forms of Krishna described in the purport. And Cupid, everyone knows he has arrows, and these arrows are fired into the heart of the conditioned souls. And what it does is it destroys all peace of mind, and it stimulates all sleeping types of lust that are present in the heart, and it brings them to an agitated state. So Krishna is a transcendental Cupid, because his arrows, we're nearly finished. His arrows, they destroy this material lust, and instead they ignite something else that's dormant within the heart, which is desire for devotional service, bhakti. It enlivens bhakti. So these arrows of Krishna that are fired into the heart of the devotee and awaken his mind, his spiritual mind and senses. I was thinking, what are these arrows? And it's described by Sridhar Swami that these arrows refer to the way that Krishna stimulates transcendental mind and senses. And for the gopis of Vrindavan, it might be something very esoteric, that when they hear Krishna's flute, they feel a certain way. But for us even, as aspiring devotees here in this material atmosphere, we also experience that Krishna can pierce our heart with different kinds of arrows to stimulate the senses. For example, the beauty of Krishna's form, it's like arrows into the eyes of the devotee. And when we hear a beautiful kirtan of Krishna's holy names, it's like arrows into the ears. And when we smell prasadam flowers and tulsi leaves and the incense that are offered to Krishna, it's like arrows that destroy the desire for mundane smell and enliven the transcendental sense of smell. And similarly, nice Krishna prasadam, it will stimulate the devotee's sense of taste. And the mind is very enlivened to hear Krishna's pastimes and hear this nice philosophy about Krishna. So we see that the trick of controlling the mind and senses is to, with great determination, bring them into contact with Krishna, who's the natural object of the purified mind and senses. And then paramdrishva nivartante, we'll be able to relish a higher taste. And we see with Srimati Radharani, for example, that she so much feels the spontaneous attraction for Krishna that sometimes she becomes bewildered. And she says, how is it possible? I'm so fallen, I'm attracted to three different people at once. And she says, the person whose name is Krishna, when I hear that name, my heart races towards him. But at the same time, I'm in the forest sometimes and I hear flute playing. And my mind very much becomes attracted to that person who's playing his flute. And sometimes also on the road around Vrindavan, I glimpse a beautiful dark boy. And when I see his form, I'm also attracted to him. So in this way, Srimati Radharani, her mind and senses are naturally attracted to Krishna. And in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya says the same thing. He says that my mind is like a chariot and it's being pulled by five uncontrollable horses. And these horses are my senses and they're all racing after Krishna. But the problem is Krishna is the object of sight and sound and smell and touch. And so therefore I feel as if my chariot of my mind is being disturbed by being pulled in five different directions at once. So this is the level of raganugara or spontaneous attraction. And if we can aspire to this platform, then there's no chance for mundane sense gratification to enter the mind of a devotee. And then we'll be situated on Brahma-Bhuta, platform prasanatma, that will be fully satisfied and experiencing Krishna. So I think we'll leave the purport there. Explanation of the purport and read the translation again. My Lord, as the supreme directing deity known as Aniruddha, you are the master of the senses and mind. I therefore offer my obeisances unto you again and again. You are known as Ananta as well as Sankarshan, because of your ability to destroy the whole creation by the blazing fire from your mouth. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Does anybody have any comment or question about the about control of mind and senses or any other subject, Prabhuji?
Yeah, once got a slight introduction to these arrows that are fired by Cupid by Sachinanda Swami. He glanced upon this point, he described the five arrows. wasn't actually able to find out where he got his information from. And I would like to get a little more insight into this. Do you happen to know where I can find him?
Do you refer to the Krishna's firing of arrows in the heart as the transcendental Cupid?
No, it's the...
How Cupid. Actually, I don't know. I'm sorry. I mean, maybe you have to write to Maharaj. Or probably devotees know, actually, that Cupid, or he's also known as Kamadev, he has five arrows that attack the heart of the conditioned soul. Does anybody know those five? I've heard it before, but I've forgotten, actually. No, I don't know. Unless maybe we do a search on Vedabase for Cupid, something might come up. Yeah. On the other end.
You spoke about purification. Mm. And then what is the meaning of purification? Well, it seems like there's a difference. It seems to be there's a difference between how we can make the terms of purification and what we know and the terms of purification. I think here we might be referring to more germs of the
Well, Bhakti Vijayapurna Maharaj, he described once that impurity is simply matter misplaced. So matter in one certain state can be considered pure, and that same matter in a different place in a different circumstance is considered impure. And he said, like, for example, as long as blood and is packed up in the body and hair is on the head, it can be considered pure, and one can go into the deity room and perform worship. But if that blood, if you cut yourself and blood comes out, or your hair drops from your head and into the cooking, then it's an impure substance. So it's kind of subtle, actually, the Vedic understanding of purity and impurity. The modern understanding is more concerned with gross things, you know, just removing gross impurities. And they consider alcohol very impure, very pure. In one sense, it's pure because it's so horrible that it will destroy life forms, you know. And so therefore, they put chemicals like chlorine in water, and they say it's purified because it's so nasty that it's killed every possible bacteria in the water. And so therefore, they say now it's pure to drink, but actually it's toxic. And similarly with fluoride and other things that they use. It's a big... scam, of course, to use up industrial waste, and so therefore they create a market for it and sell it to city councils to put in the water. But yes, purification, the idea that purification is something subtle that's and works on the platform of the mind and senses, that seems more the focus of Vedic purification. Like for a bath, we can take a bath by using dirt or sand and all kinds of things when there's no water, but you still become purified. Even mantra bath is accepted as bona fide before going in the deity room if you have no option for taking bath with water. So therefore it seems the aspect of purifying the subtle mind and body is prominent, and if that's purified, then any condition on the material level is considered purified. And so in that way we see a great sage like an Avadhut, even though he may not follow all different hygiene rules. And it's said, for example, that King Rishabhdev, when he was practicing this life of a python, that he would pass stool, and some of it might be on his body, but it smelt like sandalwood, and it was the potency not only of his transcendental body being an incarnation of Krishna, but the fact that his body was so purified by his perfect meditation. So that's one idea, that when the mind is in contact with the Supreme Pure, then all material elements, they become transcendentally energized, whether or not materially speaking they're pure or impure. I'm not an expert on purity, that's for sure. I'm a contaminated person. But the name Manasi Ganga, it implies that by meditation one can bring the Ganges, which is a very pure agent, into manifestation. So I think that was the hope of my spiritual master, that I can fix the mind on Krishna and that way get a bit of a purified mind, don't I? Anyway, yeah. Well, there's different ways to purify different things. To purify, it means to take out the unwanted part and to only have the essential part, the part that's really the essence. So when we speak about it in mundane terms, like to purify a metal, we're talking about taking out the things that may not be that same element. You know, like when we purify aluminium from... when we purify bauxite, we want to get out aluminium, so we have, you know, we take out... oxygen and other types of, you know, things from that metal. Or when we purify water, we take out little bits of hair and stones and other things that are in it, germs. So I think there's different levels of purification. But for a devotee, the most important one, I mean, it begins with the outside, because all these things have effects on the subtle body. But the ultimate point is when the mind and senses are fixed on Krishna, then because he's the supreme pure, then it has such an effect that even the external things are so-called impure, they become pure. Yeah. Okay, yes, good.
I did say that the text, that the sun god is an extension of Ayurveda.
Yeah.
Isn't the sun god from Jiva Tattva and
Aniruddha
from Samsara?
Yeah, the sun god, generally speaking, is Jiva Tattva, but it describes in the Brahma Samhita that on the order of Krishna and by the potency of Krishna, he gets his potency. So actually he's an empowered Jiva. And sometimes also Krishna himself takes the position of the sun god as Surya Narayan. But as a representative of Krishna, because he's so powerful and so purifying, because he has Krishna's potency, then the sun god is accepted as a representative. So in that way, he's Krishna. Also, his power is coming from Aniruddha, and sometimes actually it's Krishna himself, as Surya Narayan. So yeah, he's a jiva, but all jivas actually were all expansions of Krishna. So it's nothing unusual that we can refer to a jiva as being an expansion of Krishna. But according to the particular expansion, more or less potency might be represented in a certain living being. Like Krishna himself invests all of his potencies in some expansions, and then a small fragmented part with very little potency and tendency to be forgetful.